carefully evaluated for each listener based on that person's circumstances. KXCR and the individuals involved in this program, Pacifica Radio, or any station airing this program do not assume any liability from the use of any information presented. By using this information to enjoy your own coastal adventures, you assume all potential risks and agree to hold Pacifica Radio, KXCR, its affiliates, any station airing this program, and the presenters harmless from any resulting liability. Here's that nature sound again. The first time I saw red-necked phalaropes, they were swimming in their distinct circling or spinning pattern on a large pond in the Oregon Dunes. Recently, an immature red-necked phalarope landed in my backyard. While I am close to the ocean and some larger ponds, my backyard is not a normal place to see them. I began to wonder if perhaps the bird had somehow escaped the clutches of a bald eagle. It's not unheard of to find a seabird inland that has escaped a predator. One of the most interesting things about phalaropes is that the females are the larger and more brightly colored of the species. Females sometimes get into brutal fights over males and will court the male they desire by swimming around him, eventually luring him into following her. After laying eggs, females leave it to their male counterparts to care for the eggs and chicks while they seek out another male and repeat the mating and egg-laying process. Chicks leave the nest in about a day and feed themselves. The male remains with them for about 2 weeks and then flies off. Chicks, however, are unable to fly until about 3 weeks of age. Missed a show recently? You can find all of our shows on SoundCloud.com. Just search for Beyond Your Front Door Oregon and look for The Wave. Are you interested in what's coming up on Beyond Your Front Door? Check us out on Facebook and Instagram at Beyond Your Front Door Oregon. Have an idea for a show you would like to hear? Email me at dina@kxcr.net to share your idea. Thanks to Pacifica Radio member stations KBOO, KCEI, PNW Radio, and KXCR for airing Beyond Your Front Door. And thanks to Oregon-based Jumpin' the Rails for performing the theme song, Smith Chapel, used on this show. And thanks again to all of you for tuning in. I hope you have a great week and get some time beyond your front door.
Hi, this is Peter Himmelman. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM.
Andy Whoa Whoa looks a scream. Hand him on my whoa, whoa, whoa. Andy Whoa Whoa, silver scream. Can't tell them apart at all.
My name is Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Jeannie Konmetsu. She's the Arlene and Harold Schnitzer Curator of Asian Art at the Portland Art Museum. And she's here talking about Forces of Nature, a show of Japanese prints, which runs at the museum through December 31st, 2022. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus in person once again, Jeannie.
Thank you, Joseph. This is great.
I love this show. It's prints from about the last 50 years by Japanese artists, Japanese-based. Three-quarters, I think, are women. And mm-hmm. The one that really grabs you as you come in on the right, it's got to be 15 feet long. It's a two-panel, very bright, like a page from manga. And it's called Magma Spirit Explodes, Tsunami is Dreadful, 2004. And it's a print mounted to plexiglass, so it's really glossy. It's like you're looking through a sheet of plastic, very clear. And it's a digital print, so the artist made it on a computer and then printed it out big. So tell us, who is Aoshima Chiho, born in 1974.
Aoshima Chiho is a woman artist, and she's associated with Takashi Murakami's super flat aesthetic and a member of his Kaikai Kiki association. She was one of the early artists to be involved. So they've been working together at least since the 90s. And this piece, this version of it, was made in 2004. It's 2 9-foot wide panels, exactly as you describe. That kind of manga, anime aesthetic is something that you see a lot in the super flat movement, and you certainly see in Aoshima's work. It really adopts that as a language. Bright color, some elements of kind of two-dimensionality, where you get that supposed super flat aesthetic. But what you get with a lot of those artists is there's often something a little bit deeper going on. And so from afar, this is kind of a wonderful and eye-catching, distinctive piece. And then you come up close and it's full of all this intricate detail. So on the right half of the diptych, there's a kind of sea scene, and you see sort of aquatic mermaids and creatures and fish, rolling waves. There's kind of these hurricanes and forming funnels above, yeah. That's right. And then as you move into the center of the piece, it's like the tsunami wave is actually becoming this exploding volcano, sort of this anthropomorphized woman is coming out, almost as if the volcano itself is sort of being anthropomorphized as a figure. And often in Western art, when we look at pictures, there's a little bit of a tendency to read from left to right, but the way that the work is installed, you can actually read it more in the way that you would a Japanese hand scroll. It's long and narrow, so it's very similar in format. And if you read from right to left, the transformation is actually from that of a tsunami wave into a kind of fiery spirit, sort of literally forming from the depths, and they're kind of meeting in the middle. So So one of the things that for me that this piece evokes is actually comes from much earlier Japanese art, which is the Hell Scrolls, which are known for this kind of terrifying imagery that imagines the levels of hell and the levels of torment there. So it's a really, I think it's a really fascinating piece. As I said, she created it in 2004. There have been different versions of it. There have been sort of mural-sized versions of this piece. But she has written about the fact that after 2011, when the Great East Japan earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear meltdown occurred, her relationship to the piece and how she thought about it really changed. It's really a kind of prescient piece, thinking about, you know, what has happened in the wake.
So you, on the right, you're right, as you come in, you do tend to start at the right-hand end of it. And the first section is a big blue wave crashing onto,
it's really a cityscape here.
Yeah, there's a city which is catching fire, but I feel like there's a, or it's magma, it's like lava, I think, which is weird. It's like an earthquake by the sea. I guess it's like Hawaii, where the lava comes out of the ground and the sea crashes on it, creating steam. But it's also an earthquake because the city's on fire. But out of this emerges a woman's face. It's kind of a very cutesy cartoon girl with fire hair and little other characters sort of falling off her. Tiny, like people falling from buildings almost, or maybe they're flying. And she's looking to the left, and then the rest of it is all fire, and it looks like those flames you'd paint on the side of a hot rod, you know, cartoon flames with dark outlines. But out of them emerges a kind of skull-like face with spiral eyes, blowing, made of fire, and also blowing fire, I think. And then the background of that is black. I think there are stars. But there's also this sort of very blurry stuff in the background. It could be another skull, sort of airbrushy. It's a totally different register from everything else. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the idea of flatness as that group conceived it?
There's a lot out there now on Murakami. I remember when I was first learning about his work, and it was like the American art world hadn't caught on, or the international art world yet, and there was very little you could find on them. But you can find a lot now, and a lot of their own writings, which I think is great. But part of what they were doing was adopting this language, which, you know, one was partly inspired by Tezuka Osamu and his work as an early artist in Japan. There's also a relationship to the import of Western cartoons, particularly like Mickey Mouse.
Mm-hmm.
Like that kind of, yeah,
movies.
Really early sort of cartoon language, mm-hmm. imported to Japan in the immediate post-war period. And for Murakami himself, it's actually a rather political way of expressing kind of a Japanese visual language. But for different artists, it means different things. And I think for Aoshima, it's her mode of expression is, although it looks very much perhaps like might remind you of anime imagery you've seen or manga, I think it is quite uniquely her own. I mean, she's certainly borrowing those influences. She's very upfront about that. But if you look, one of my favorite parts of the piece is actually where none of the action is taking place. It's these kind of green orbs that are floating in this purple-pink Lisa Frank kind of sky. I mean, it's almost like the mouth of this, like, a small earth has opened up and is pouring water down into the sea. But the level of detail, and of course this is computer manipulated and drawn imagery, but the level of detail and color and just kind of this explosion of kind of lush, beautiful vegetation and flowers. I mean, it's just really, it's quite mm-hmm. beautiful and interesting. So I think it's a piece where the more you look, of course it's full of detail, but the more you look, the more it sort of has to offer. I don't think she's offering necessarily a specific, you know, narrative or a specific sort of moral take on the relationship of humans to their environment. But I think it's there certainly to be interpreted by the viewer, if they so wish.
Over by the door, there's a piece by Iwami Reika. It's called Living on the Moon, 1998. And it's a mostly black and white print. And I think it's waves of water, although I see a kind of butterfly in gold coming out of the center. There's a big circle in the center, sort of incomplete. And then there are other waves that are embossed in the paper. And then the gold of the butterfly also shows up in different places. It's also painted thickly over the embossed white paper. And then the bottom of the piece is just jet black. So it's abstract, but it's definitely makes you think about nature immediately. Is it a picture of the moon? Living on the Moon?
Well, she titled it Living on the Moon, and so yes, in a way, although some of these elements are things that Iwami Reika returned to over and over again. Wave forms, you can see also along the bottom, kind of mixed in with the black lower register, the wood grain of, you know, sort of found wood that she was quite famous for working with, the butterflies also. These are all elements that she would return to over and over again for decades. This is a woodblock print. I was asked once if it was a, you know, an intaglio, like an etching, because I think her palette is so restricted. It's black, gray, white, and then these hits of gold and silver. So I think she's someone that people are really drawn to, because her work is so striking. But as you say, it's you know, it's abstract and it's kind of warm and inviting at the same time, with this theme of living on the moon, which is a kind of poetic title in my mind.
Mm-hmm. So it could be the moon with clouds in front of it, although it is kind of like a sunset because you've got the dark foreground and the light sky.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a kind of a different set of interpretations throughout this show, but one of the common themes is that a number of the works really leave open-ended a lot of questions about what are they representing, what relationship is the artist representing between themselves and their subject. In this case, kind of an abstract representation of, are you on the moon? Are you gazing at the moon? Do you see yourself in the moon? That's also a kind of a common poetic trope in Japanese literature. So it may be that she was thinking to some degree about that resonance as well. Mm-hmm.
Do you know how she got the embossed waveforms in the paper?
Yes, so she would use kind of what we used to call blind printing, where you'd have a surface that was really well built up, or that was carved into more deeply. She typically used large sheets of plywood that were pretty easy to manipulate. But of course, Iwami was pretty short of stature and diminutive, so I like to imagine her really pressing her whole body as she presses the paper into that surface to get that amazing texture.
So she pushed wood into the wet paper and mm-hmm. it left a mark.
Yeah, and probably it would have been paper on top of the wood. That's very common in Japanese woodblock printing, where you would use a tool, traditionally a baren, which is a kind of a round wrapped implement that fits really nicely in the hand. And then you could rub and press the back of the paper into your printing matrix. And since you're not pulling, say, 100,000 prints, you know, it's feasible to do that all by hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it says in the corner, 3 of 30. What are the Japanese letters say at the bottom?
They say Tsuki ni sumu, or living on the moon, and then she signed it there on the right.
Mm-hmm. Was Iwami Reika in the previous show you had of women printers from Japan?
Good eye. Yes, she was. She was one of the founding members of Jōryūhanga Kyōkai, or the Japan Women's Women Printmakers Association, which was active from the mid-50s to the mid-60s. But Iwami went on and had a really successful career.
Mm-hmm. And these are all from the Portland Art Museum's collection,
that's
is that right?
Correct. Everything in this exhibition are recent acquisitions. None of them have ever been on view before. So that's another nice thing, to be able to bring them out for people to enjoy.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Jeannie Konmetsu. She's the Arlene and Harold Schnitzer Curator of Asian Art at the Portland Art Museum. She's talking about Forces of Nature, which is on at the museum through December 31st. Ozeki Ritsuko has a piece called Unravel Number 3. It's quite new. It's 2017. Mm-hmm. Etching and aquatint on paper. It's very abstract. It's a sort of off-white with a lot of very dark matte black marks. The kind of only shapes I can see look like flowers or wheels maybe, or maybe seaweed. And that's about all I can say about this.
Well, I really love this piece. If you get really close, you can see it has this kind of iridescent quality to the paper, if you can get the light to hit it quite right, which just gives it this really different sort of sparkle. Ozeki had done an earlier series that was really thinking about lace and textiles and the relationship to the body of these distinctly kind of feminine garments. And so she was thinking about kind of the relationship of lace to a woman's body and the way it might then, when she revisited that theme in this series, thinking about it literally coming apart and disintegrating. And as you said, she made this piece in 2017. So at this point, we are 6 years on from the 2011 Great Tohoku earthquake and disaster. And as you know, in the wake of that terrible tragedy, all kinds of things washed up on shore, including, of course, people's clothing. And so she was reflecting in part on that kind of imagery and thinking about sort of the kind of disrupted, broken apart new reality of the post-311 world in Japan.
The notes on it reference the torn fabric of a wedding dress, a lace dress, and then also fishing nets.
Yeah, there's a kind of an aquatic theme to some degree in the gallery. The title of the show is Forces of Nature, but it's really less about nature and more about how we think about our own relationship to the natural world and just to our environment generally, and how do artists envision this? How do artists visualize that for us? And so one of the uniting themes in this for much of the show is really water.
How does it work when you're putting this together? Are you in a basement with the stacks and you're just like looking through them? Or are you got your head in a book? Were you flying around the world?
Well, I wasn't flying around the world for this. I started to think about this during the pandemic when I wasn't traveling. Really in 2021, you know, I put together that Joryuhanga Kyokai show. It opened in 2020, closed, opened again. So I really was thinking about what are some of the new things we've brought in? What unites them? What makes them interesting? How might they play with other work in our collection? You know, a museum can hold in its permanent collection thousands of pieces, but you can't have them all on view at any one time, and particularly works on paper or silk or that have other constraints where they need to be protected from light exposure. They need to rotate and they need to change. So a lot of those things were in play here. It wasn't as documentary as some of the other kinds of shows I've done that have had a lot of really intense art historical research. But I think one of the other things about this exhibition is, you know, these are prints. All prints here are created in the last 50 years, most of them from the 90s till now, I think. So this is a really, really contemporary sort of thoughts about the Japanese artists' sort of perspective on a relationship to their environment. And it's very difficult today to think about that relationship without thinking about 2011. It was just such a pivotal, transformational moment that is still impacting thousands of people even today. Mm-hmm. So can't really hold one without the other.
One of the bigger pieces is by Aki Mana, and it's called The Day I Saw the Wind. Again, 2016 woodblock print on paper. And from a distance, it looks like a lowercase letter I with an extra dot above it, set on a, this is very black, set on a background of kind of leaf patterns, sort of pointed leaves or flame shapes, very repetitive, done, you know, scratched, I think, into the blackness. And then there's two black circles, well, one black oval, but two white circles, again, cutting through everything.
Yeah, a lot of Akimana's work has these kind of geometric, but sort of soft, organic geometric shapes. And a lot of her work is much smaller. Aki doesn't live in Tokyo like a lot of contemporary Japanese printmakers. She lives further out in the countryside. A lot of her work has these beautiful poetic titles, but they seem very personal in nature and very tied to sort of her personal experiences moving through life. Sometimes they're sort of oblique, sometimes they're more sort of apparent. What attracted me to this piece in part was that, you know, some of her work is light in color, but this work, which is monochrome, is really just working with ink on white paper, manages to achieve such an incredible range of tone and variation, which you don't often see in woodblock printmaking. And the paper, it's a little bit hard to tell now that it's matted and framed and on the wall and there's a light above it, but the paper itself is so beautifully tissue thin and strong. And so when I first saw this piece, it made me think of almost like feathers waving in the wind. I don't know that she was thinking about that. In fact, if anything, they might be more like blades of grass.
Does she make the paper herself?
I don't think so.
No, so yeah. This is handmade. Is the paper cut where the image ends?
No, the paper black? Extends
okay.
Beyond the
so
edge
there's
of
a little,
the mark.
A little centimeter border where the print finishes. What kind of contraption would you make a big print like this in? What does it look like?
I'm pretty sure it looks just like it did for Iwami Reika on the other side of the room. The press is really her body and her hands and her arms. And this is a very large piece. So to achieve an even level of pressure all at the same time would be impossible, of course, without a press. But my understanding is she doesn't use a press at all. It's also her body pressing into the paper. Actually, if you get close, you can see these kinds of strokes almost horizontally mm-hmm. across the paper, and you can almost imagining, you know, the artist's hand holding that baton or whatever she's using for pressure.
Just in the doorway, there are two brightly colored prints. One looks like a kind of red Mount Fuji with clouds and mist, clouds above the cone and mist above the city. And then it's sort of a red mountain on a yellow background. And then a few feet away, there's another piece, and it looks like a yellow field with a green river cutting through it. The channels are eating into the I don't know, there's vegetation, but the riverbank. And then there's this many different types of turquoise and green that capture the depth of the water. Who are these two artists?
So on the left with the red Mount Fuji, this is Sekino Junichiro, who is probably the oldest of all the artists represented here. He's no longer alive, but was of the earliest generation. He was one of the early Sosakuhanga, or creative print movement artists. Really prolific, incredible, in my mind, master of color. I mean, just when you walk in the gallery, I think it's really apparent. This is one of his, in some ways, more understated works. There are fewer colors here. There are fewer blocks, because every color you see on the print, from the dark kind of mustard yellow at the top to the lighter yellow behind, and then same with the red, shades of red on Mount Fuji, all of those are a separate block. So it's a separate impression on the paper.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the right, I thought it might be interesting to show the work of one of his sons, actually, Sekino Yosaku. This is also in our collection. Yosaku, you know, started by assisting his father in the studio and then became a printmaker in his own right. And his subject, you know, we've got sort of the fiery mountain in effect on one side, and on the other these kind of really cool teal, green, blue hues that just really make you think about like water cutting through a marshland, which is his subject. I think it's really interesting to contrast their work and see what kind of technical geniuses they were at color woodblock printmaking.
Mm-hmm. How many passes do you think it took to do this river one? I mean, there's so many different colors and they're all almost blended.
Almost 30 to 40, something mm-hmm. like that. I had a chance to see him actually carving a piece a few years ago. And it's just absolutely intricate and amazing. The level of labor, physical labor, and effort that goes into crafting every one of those wood blocks, let alone the finished print. It's almost hard to appreciate seeing the finished work, how much went into them.
Mm-hmm. It seems like wood block printing, not just alive and well over there, but taken to a new level, sort of. Have intricacy.
I think to some degree, I think both the Sekino's work offered, on one side of the gallery is really nice to see. you know, the counterpoint on the other side of the gallery of kind of the new generation and what directions are they taking it in, what are they doing, whether it's abstract or representational, where are they taking the medium? Because I think there's room for all of it.
My name is Joseph Gallivan, and you've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Jeannie Konmetsu. She's the Arlene and Harold Schnitzer Curator of Asian Art at the Portland Art Museum. She was talking about the show Forces of Nature, which is Japanese prints, and it's up through December 31st, 2022. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus again, Jeannie.
Thanks, Joseph. This was a lot of fun.
Andy walking, Andy tired. Andy take a little snooze. Tie him up when he fast asleep. Send him on a pleasant cruise. When you wake up on the sea, be sure to think of me and you. To think about paint and to think about glue. What a jolly boring thing to do.
Andy Warhol, let's just scream, hang him on.